This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of The Trapped Girl by Robert Dugoni, performed by Emily Sutton Smith. To Dr. Joe Doucette, words can't describe how grateful I am for your time, expertise, and guidance. See you at 90. Even a dog knows the difference between being stumbled over and being kicked. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. Chapter 1. Seattle, Washington. Saturday, June 24th, 2017. Kurt Schill dragged his 14-foot aluminum boat across the beach logs he'd set to minimize the scraping of the hull against the rocks. He wanted to protect his recent investment, but he really wanted to avoid a confrontation with the residents living in the condominiums and apartments bordering the narrow access to Puget Sound. At 4:30 in the morning, they would not take kindly to having their peace disrupted. If they bitched to the police about Schill launching his boat from what was strictly a walking path, he would have little to say in his defense. The posted signs were frequent and explicit. Schill entered the water to steady the boat and felt the chill of the 46-degree Puget Sound through his rubber boots. He gave the boat a shove and leapt in, banging his knee hard, the boat rocking and rolling until he'd adjusted his weight on the center seat. The V-shaped hull felt more stable than his fiberglass boat, which was difficult to maneuver when the water got rough. He'd have to wait until he got a bit farther away before he fired up the 6-horsepower Honda engine and got the real feel. He slid the wooden oars into the row locks and rowed from shore, silent but for the splash of the blades and the click of the oarlock with each stroke. The aluminum hull glided across the pitch-black waters. One more thing he was digging about the new rig. He'd saved his money and bought it off a guy on Craigslist for $2,000, boat and trailer. It was more than the $1,500 he'd budgeted. His father had helped him out, though he'd have to pay back that money. He figured he could save by avoiding boat launch fees at the local marinas and by hauling in more crab. Fish and Game put a limit of 5 Dungeness per person, but Chill wasn't about to throw any keepers back. Not with his restaurant contacts paying cash under the table. He rowed in the direction of Blake Island, a black hump rising out of the water, though dwarfed by the shadowy presence of the significantly larger islands behind it, Bainbridge and Vashon. To the north, the lights of the eastbound Bremerton ferry inching toward Seattle made it look like an illuminated water bug. Perspiration trickled down his chest and back beneath his waders and life vest, and Schill was thankful for the light breeze blowing cool on his neck. Several hundred yards offshore, he shipped the oars and moved to the rear of the boat. He hooked the kill switch to his life vest, squeezed the ball on the fuel line 3 times to pump gas to the engine, adjusted the choke, and pulled the ripcord. The engine cranked, sputtered, and died. He made sure the gear was in neutral and the throttle on the tiller twisted to the turtle, and pulled again. The engine chugged and sputtered. Then it kicked to life. Legally, only the Native American tribes could crab this early in the season, and the fine if you got caught was steep. But Schill had found a sweet honey hole at the end of last year's run, and he was eager to find out if it was still producing. To avoid detection, he set his pots after sundown and retrieved them before sunrise. Still, there were risks. Running without a light increased his chance of being hit by another boat or hitting a log floating on the water. Either would ruin your day, big time. Schill turned the tiller hard to the right, and the bow swung sharply. In no time, the hull was cutting across the surface, leaving a V-shaped wake. Sweet. As he neared his honey hole, he eased back on the throttle, slowing, and searching the shoreline for the split tree, his landmark. Spotting it, he flipped the engine into neutral and scanned the surface of the water for a conical-shaped shadow, his red and white buoy. He felt anxious when he didn't see it. Tribal members took gear that infringed on their fishing rights. Retrieving the flashlight from beneath his seat, he skimmed the light across the surface. On the third pass, he spotted his buoy, bobbing up and down in the waves. Relieved, he motored to it, grabbed the ring, and took up the slack in the rope until he felt the weight of the crab pot. He looped the rope onto the block wheel at the end of the davit pole, another perk he didn't have on his smaller fiberglass boat, and continued pulling in line, coiling it at his feet. "Crab time," he said. He'd become pretty good at estimating his haul from the weight of the pot. It wasn't foolproof. He'd brought up heavy pots only to find them filled with sunflower stars, flounder, and rockfish. This pot felt heavier than any he'd ever pulled up, and his shoulders soon burned. He had to tie off the rope to give his arms a break. "Damn," he said, feeling that familiar flutter of anticipation in his stomach. He braced the soles of his rubber boots against the side of the hull, untied the rope, and immediately felt the weight of the cage. The boat listed starboard side, the davit pole tipping down toward the water. Shill estimated he'd pulled in 60 feet of line, which still left about 20 feet to go. Something didn't seem right, though. The rope was not perpendicular to the water, but angled at 45 degrees, which usually indicated a snag. Whatever it was coming up first, his basket somewhere beneath it. That worried him. If he'd snagged a big bed of seaweed or a lost boat anchor and had to cut it free, he could end up cutting his rope and losing his pot. Goodbye profit margins. He gave another pull, the muscles of his thighs, arms, and shoulders now all burning. Sweat trickled down his forehead into his eyes and he shook it away. Finally, a crab pot broke the water's surface. Though hard to see, it appeared rectangular. His pot was an octagon. Either his line had become entangled with the line of a pot set close by, or he'd snagged a rogue pot. He tied off the rope and carefully slid across the bench seat. The davit pole lowered another 6 inches. Reaching carefully for the rope, afraid he might tip the boat over, he grabbed it and dragged the pot close enough to reach the cage, holding it close. With his free hand, he retrieved the flashlight and directed the beam over the contents. The pot looked full, but with what? He saw seaweed and starfish, but also a few crabs scurrying about, feeding. Then he saw the hand. Chapter 2. Tracy Crosswhite parked her Ford F-150 facing north on Beach Drive Southwest, pulled her blonde hair into a ponytail, and quickly wrapped it in a hair tie. She didn't wear a ponytail often anymore. At 43, she didn't want to come off as one of those women still trying to look a perky 23, but at this hour of the morning, she didn't feel perky and didn't much care what she looked like. She hadn't showered, and she hadn't bothered to put on any makeup. She opened the notepad app on her cell phone and scrolled to just below her first entry. She dictated the time she'd received the call from Billy Williams, her detective sergeant at the Seattle Police Department's Violent Crimes Section. She hit the microphone button and said, "Time, 5:45 a.m., parked on Beach Drive Southwest near Cormorant Cove." Williams had called roughly 20 minutes earlier. Dispatch had received a 911 call about a body in Puget Sound, and the skull of death hung from Tracy's cubicle. Literally, a fake skull the detectives hung on the cubicle of the homicide team on call. In this case, Tracy and her partner, Kensington Rowe. Williams had said he was still gathering facts, but someone had reported finding the body near Cormorant Cove, which was just a few miles from Tracy's rented home in West Seattle's Admiral District. She'd beat everyone to the scene except the responding officers. Their patrol cars sat parked across the street, facing the opposite direction. Tracy stepped down from the truck's cab, A slice of the fading moon in a pale blue sky grinned at her. The temperature, already pleasant, meant another day of unpleasant heat. With 6 days above 90 degrees, this June was shaping up to be the hottest on record. Tracy dictated another note. Weather is clear, no appreciable wind. She checked the weather app on her phone and said, 53 degrees in West Seattle. A Saturday morning. The beaches and elevated sidewalk would soon be teeming with dog walkers, joggers, and families out for a stroll. Encountering a dead body on the beach would put a real damper on the start to their weekend. She grabbed her SPD ball cap, threaded her ponytail through the gap for adjusting the size, and tugged the bill low on her forehead. Next came the 50 SPF sunscreen, which she rubbed on her arms, neck, chest, and face. She'd had a scare 2 months earlier when her doctor noticed a discoloration near her collarbone during a routine exam. A subsequent trip to the dermatologist revealed skin damage, but no cancer. The joys of getting older. Crow's feet, belly fat, and applying sunscreen before going outside. She jaywalked to the three black and whites, two sedans and an SUV, parked in front of the Harbor West apartment complex. Built on pilings and piers pounded deep into the mud, the complex extended out over the Sound and gave new meaning to the term living on the water. No thanks. One sizable earthquake could snap one of those wood beams. Then again, her home was perched on a 200-foot hillside. When you chose view over practicalities, you picked your poison, though this view was spectacular. Vashon and Bainbridge Islands and the much smaller Blake Island created the picturesque backdrop that warranted the exorbitant rents and condominium prices along Beach Drive Southwest. Three uniformed officers on a footpath watched Tracy's approach from behind black and yellow crime scene tape. Tracy didn't bother showing them her shield. Even without the branding on her windbreaker and ball cap, after more than 20 years, she knew she'd acquired a cop's self-assured gait and demeanor. "Tracy," a female officer said. She also remained Seattle's only female homicide detective, and she'd recently received her second Medal of Valor for a high-profile investigation and capture of a serial killer known as the Cowboy. Frankly, she could have done without the attention. She and her partner, Kins, had heard the whispers around police headquarters about how they always seemed to be the team on call when the department got a whodunit. The insinuation that their captain, Johnny Nolasco, was feeding them cases was more than absurd. Tracy and Nolasco got along worse than those women on the Housewives of Wherever television shows. "Katie," Tracy said. Katie Pryor worked out of the Southwest precinct. She was one of the many officers Tracy had trained to shoot to pass her qualifying exam. "How are you?" Pryor asked. "I could use more sleep," Tracy said. Instinctively, she was already considering the area as a whole. She noted beach logs leading to the water and a young man standing beside a beached aluminum fishing boat. A taut rope extended 8 to 10 feet off the back of the boat, then plunged into the blue-gray water. Tracy questioned why a beached boat would need an anchor. "I take it that's the guy who reported finding the body?" Pryor looked over her shoulder. "His name's Kurt Schill." Tracy shifted her gaze up and down the rocky beach, which was strewn with bleached white logs. "So where is it?" Pryor said. "I'll walk you in." Tracy scribbled her name on the sign-in sheet and ducked beneath the tape. Pryor handed the clipboard to one of the two remaining officers. Tracy noticed people starting to linger on the beach and turned to the other officers. "Move everyone off the beach and onto the elevated sidewalk. Tell them the beach is going to be closed most of the day, and find out if anybody saw anything or knows anything." She surveyed Beach Drive, spotting a blue truck with a boat trailer. After you move them, write down the license plate numbers of every car parked along Beach Drive to 61st Avenue and back down Spokane Street. She knew the three streets intersected, creating a scalene triangle with Beach Drive Southwest making up the longest side. It was not unheard of for a killer, if they were dealing with a murder, to come back to the crime scene and watch the investigation unfold. They moved toward the water. After the cumulative days of hot weather, the beach held a distinct briny smell. A uniformed officer, bent over, hammered a stick into the sand, presumably to tie the other end of the crime scene tape he'd strung to create a U-shaped perimeter. "We got the call from dispatch at 5:32, Pryor said, her boots sinking into the rocks and making a sound like rattling change. When we arrived, he was waiting for us by his boat.
What did you say his name was?
Kurt Schill. He's a high school student here in West Seattle. Tracy stopped walking to consider the logs positioned parallel to the water.
Did he do this?
Not sure, Pryor said. Looks like a makeshift boat ramp. She took a couple pictures with her cell. He said he was crabbing and his pot snagged something as he pulled it up, Pryor said.
A body?
Tracy asked, thinking that would be a first.
Another crab pot.
I thought he found a body.
He's pretty sure he did, Pryor said. Inside the pot. Tracy looked from Pryor to the boat and beyond it to the taut line. Not an anchor. She'd come to the site predisposed to find a body on the shore, perhaps a drowning or boating accident, what they referred to in the section as a grounder or easy play. If the body was inside a crab pot, that changed everything. In a big, freaking way.
Have you seen it?
The body? Pryor shook her head.
Water's too deep, and I'm not sure I want to. The kid said he thought he saw a hand sticking out from under crab and starfish.
Creepy stuff. He towed it back here.
A hand? Or the whole body? Tracy asked.
He said he saw a hand. Based on his description of the weight of the pot, though, likely the whole body. Tracy reconsidered the young man. She could only imagine the horror of seeing a decomposing body fed on by marine life. She followed Pryor to the water's edge. Waves lapped gently over the rocks. The officer establishing the perimeter stood and wiped perspiration from his forehead.
"Thanks for setting the perimeter," Tracy said. "But we're going to need it to be a lot bigger, all the way down to those logs and up to the boardwalk. I'm going to ask for a screen to block the view from the seawall, and I'll need you to set it up when it gets here. You haven't moved or touched anything?"
"Nothing but a few rocks to drive the stakes," Pryor's partner said.
"What about Harbor Patrol? Anybody call them to send out divers?" Tracy asked.
"Not yet," Pryor said. "We figured it best to leave everything as is until somebody came up with a plan." Tracy spoke to the second officer.
"Call it in. Tell them we're going to need them to set a perimeter offshore to keep boats away until we find out what we're dealing with."
She turned to Pryor. "What was the guy in the boat's demeanor when he got here?"
"Pretty shaken up, confused, frightened."
"What did he have to say?"
Pryor looked to her notes. "He said he went out early this morning to retrieve his pot down near Lincoln Park. He said he'd set it in about 80 feet of water, and when he pulled it up it felt way too heavy. When it broke the surface, he realized it wasn't his pot."
"It's not?" Tracy asked.
"No, apparently he snagged it. Said when he brought it closer he used a flashlight and saw what he thinks is a human hand. Scared the crap out of him. He dropped the cage, and the weight of it nearly pulled his boat over. He managed to tow it back until it grounded, beached the boat. He called 911 on his cell."
"What else do we know about him?"
"He just finished his sophomore year at West Seattle High and lives over on 43rd Street. His parents are on their way."
"What's a teenage boy doing up this early?"
Pryor smiled.
"I know, right? He said he sets his pots early so he's not competing with the bigger boats."
Tracy picked up on Pryor's intonation.
You don't believe him? Pryor said, The thing is, it's not crabbing season yet. Not for anyone but the tribes. You know that?
Dale and I crab a little. We do it mostly to take the girls out on the boat. The tribes can crab pretty much whenever they want. For everyone else, the season doesn't open for another week. July 2nd, I believe.
So why's he out here?
He said he didn't know. Personally, I think he's playing dumb.
Why?
Pryor nodded to the aluminum boat. That's a pretty good rig right there. Guy with that kind of rig would more than likely know the rules. The fines can be steep. I think he was sneaking out early to get a jump on the season and poach a few crabs from the tribes. Some local restaurants pay good money. Not a bad way for an enterprising high school kid to make some cash.
Except it's illegal.
Yeah, there's that, Pryor said.
Introduce me, Tracy said. Then I'd appreciate it if you could take some pictures for me with your cell, everything and anything.
They approached Kurt Schill together. Tracy allowed Pryor to make the introduction. Then Pryor walked off to take pictures. Schill extended his hand and gave a surprisingly strong handshake. He didn't look like he was old enough to shave yet. Acne pocked his forehead.
Are you doing all right? Tracy asked.
Schill nodded.
Yeah.
You want to sit down? She motioned to one of the beach logs.
No, I'm okay.
I understand you've been talking to Officer Pryor about what happened this morning. Would you mind if I asked you a few questions?
No.
Schill closed his eyes and shook his head.
Sorry, I mean sure.
Okay, just take it slow, Tracy said. When did you set your crab pot?
Schill's brow furrowed.
I guess it was... I'm not exactly sure.
Mr. Schill? Tracy waited until Schill made eye contact.
I'm not fishing game, okay?
I don't care about any of that. I just need you to be honest and tell me exactly what you did so I can find out whether you saw anything.
Whether I saw anything?
Let's back up. Start with when you set your pot.
Last night, around 10:30.
Okay, so I'm assuming it was dark. Schill nodded.
Pretty dark, yeah.
In June, in Seattle, the sun didn't set until after 9 o'clock, and twilight could linger another 45 minutes. Did you see anyone else out on the water? Any other boats?
Maybe one or two.
Crabbing?
No, just out there. I think one might have been trolling.
Fishing?
For salmon.
In the same area where you set your pot? Tracy asked.
No, I just saw them, you know.
Nothing unusual, then?
Unusual? Like what?
Was there anything that caught your attention, gave you pause, made you look twice? Anything at all?
Oh, no, nothing really.
What time did you return this morning?
Around 4.
Why set the pot so late and retrieve them so early? Tracy asked, though she suspected she knew the answer. Schill frowned.
To get the pot before anyone saw me.
You do this often? Another sheepish grimace.
A couple times this week.
And again, did you see any other boats or anything that gave you pause or second thoughts? Schill took a moment before answering. Then he shook his head.
Not really, no.
Can you take me to the spot where you pulled up the pot?
Now?
Schill asked, sounding alarmed. No, in a little while. We're going to have some divers come out, and I'd like you to take us back to where you found the pot.
Okay,
Schill said, sounding reluctant. Is that a problem? Tracy asked.
I have an SAT prep class this morning.
I think you're going to miss it today, Tracy said.
Oh.
Your parents are on their way?
My dad's coming.
Okay, you just hold tight for a bit, Tracy said. She started to walk to where Pryor was taking pictures. Schill called out.
Detective?
Tracy turned back.
Yes? I don't think she's been down there too long.
Tracy stepped back toward him. You think it's a woman?
Well, I mean, I don't know for certain, but the hand, the fingernails, they still had polish on them.
She considered the information.
Okay. Anything else?
No. Katie Pryor called Tracy's name and pointed to the road. A KRIX Channel 8 news van with a satellite dish protruding from the roof had parked on the street, and the violent crime section's favorite muckraker, Maria Van Pelt, was stepping out the passenger door. Van Pelt had been a rising star in the local news media, a good-looking blonde who seemed to have a nose for the sensational, but she'd got her hand slapped for mishandling coverage of the cowboy. Tracy had not seen her for several months, and absence had not made the heart grow fonder. At the violent crime section, the detectives referred to Van Pelt as Man Pelt, and speculated that one of the men she clung to was none other than their captain, Johnny Nolasco. Tracy called Billy Williams on her cell. She told him to have CSI bring a tent in addition to the screen. They'd set the tent up at the water's edge to serve as a command center and provide further privacy. She suspected news helicopters would not be far behind the vans. She could seek a no-fly zone, but if the news stations thought the story worthy, they'd just pay the fine. As Tracy listened to Williams, she turned back to the water. Her eyes followed the rope off the back of the boat. Definitely not a grounder. The circus had come to the beach, and so had the crowds. People stood elbow to elbow along the metal railing, news reporters and cameramen among them. Add several police vehicles, two blue and white harbor patrol boats sweeping the sound to keep sail and powerboats at bay, a gaggle of uniformed and plain-clothed officers, and a tent, and the allure was too much to resist. Even the tourists were ignoring two of the region's most iconic views, the booming image of Mount Rainier dominating the southern horizon, and the gleaming white stucco walls and red tile roofs of the Alki Point Lighthouse to the north, with Elliott Bay and the Seattle skyline serving as a spectacular backdrop. Divers had managed to retrieve the tangled mess behind Kurt Schill's boat, which had grounded in less than 10 feet of water. Schill's pot, perhaps 2 feet in diameter, would be accompanying his boat and his car to the police impound, where CSI would process it for fingerprints and DNA. The larger pot remained inside the tent, and its contents had indeed been gruesome. The body inside the pot was that of a woman. Naked, her bloated skin had turned the color and consistency of abalone meat, pale gray, rubbery, and traversed by a road map of purple lines. It showed evidence where marine life had fed. In sharp contrast to that gruesome image were the bright blue fingernails. They looked like the painted nails on the hand of a porcelain doll, nicked and scratched after years of use. The debate continued inside the tent on how to transport the body to the ME's office on Jefferson Street in downtown Seattle. Although Tracy controlled the crime scene as the ranking detective, her authority did not extend to the body. That was the ME's domain, and King County Medical Examiner Stuart Funk could be righteous about it. Funk had opted not to remove the body from the pot to avoid the potential of disturbing evidence. Problem was, no one was certain whether the pot would fit in the back of the ME's blue van, and everyone wanted to avoid having to flip it on its side with the crowd watching. Funk sent someone in search of a tape measure. Tracy waited outside the tent with Kins, Billy Williams, and Vic Fazio and Delmo Castigliano, the other two members of the violent crime section's A-team, and the next team up for a homicide. Dressed in slacks, sport coats, and loafers, Faz and Dell looked like New Jersey hitmen unsuccessfully trying to blend in on Cocoa Beach.
The King County prosecutor had also sent Rick Ceraboni, a senior prosecutor from its most dangerous offender project, MDOP. Tracy had worked several homicides with Ceraboni, though there was little for him to do at what was a highly untraditional crime scene. Evidence would likely be limited. Salt water would have destroyed fingerprints and DNA on the cage, and since the pot had been submerged in 80 feet of water, there was no sense scouring the beach for other evidence. "No way to even know where a boat would have put in," Tracy explained to the others. "There are several ramps along this side of the beach, and you have the Don Armani ramp around the point, assuming they even used a ramp. Shill didn't."
"They could have put in anywhere from the San Juan Islands to Olympia," Foz said, the words sounding as if they were scraping his throat and thick with his New Jersey accent. He alternately wiped his brow and the back of his neck with a handkerchief.
"I don't think so," Tracy said. "They would have dumped the body in deeper water, farther out from shore. I suspect it's here because it was convenient. The killer knows the area, or he didn't have to travel far."
"Any idea when she was dumped?"
Dell said. "Funk's initial impression is a couple of days at most. There's very little swelling of the hands, and the outer layer of skin remains intact."
"Still going to be like looking for a needle in a haystack," Foz said.
"Maybe,"
Dell said.
"But I'd take those odds over the odds the kid randomly hooked onto the pot."
"You don't think he did?" Tracy said.
"Just saying it's a hell of a coincidence," Dell said.
"Bet he won't be eating crab anytime soon," Foz said.
Tracy looked to ensure that no patrol officers stood close by. With new rules in place, officers were required to wear body cameras. That meant everyone had to be more careful about what they said and with their facial expressions. Detectives laughing at a crime scene easily could be misconstrued. The general public didn't understand that Gallo's humor was often a defense mechanism detectives employed to do their job without throwing up. Cell phones had made the scrutiny of police conduct worse. Now everyone was an amateur videographer. Williams pointed to the two buildings closest to the beach access.
"Let's canvass the buildings and the local marinas. Maybe somebody saw something."
"Be easier if we could get a decent picture of the victim first," Foz said. "See if anyone recognizes her."
"Are we jumping the gun?" Kins asked.
"Maybe we get lucky and her prints are in the system. She could be a hooker or a junkie."
"Doubt the killer would have bothered to go to this extreme to dispose of the body if she was a hooker or a junkie," Tracy said.
"Well, if she isn't a hooker or a junkie, then someone should have reported her as missing," Kin said.
"This is the way the Goombas do it back in my hometown," Foz said. "One tap to the back of the head and you sleep with the fishes."
"You might be right," Kin said.
He looked to Williams.
"I'm just saying we could save a step."
Williams shook his head.
"Let's ask now, when everything is fresh. Besides, if she was shot, it means there's another crime scene somewhere."
"Which might be as easy to find as determining where the boat put in," Kin said. Funk exited the tent. For a change, he did not resemble an absent-minded professor. A recent haircut had tamed his silver hair, which often looked as though Funk didn't own a comb, and the sunglasses he'd donned were far more fashionable than the silver-framed spectacles too large for his narrow head.
"We can fit the cage in the van. I'll take it back to the office," he said. "But I won't get to it today."
"Any tattoos or piercings?" Tracy asked.
"Not that I can initially see," Funk said.
"What about track marks?"
Kins asked. Funk shook his head.
"Again, I don't know yet." "How long you estimate she's been down there, Doc?" Foz asked.
2 to 3 days, Funk said. "No more."
"I want to keep the crab pot intact as much as possible," Tracy said. "Maybe something on it will provide a clue where it came from."
"I'll do my best," Funk said.
"Call us when you get to her," Tracy said. As Funk departed, Williams turned to Dell and Foz.
Get started canvassing the buildings.
Tracy and Kins would go with Harbor Patrol to where Shill had found the pot.
Let's meet back downtown later this afternoon.
As Tracy and Kins walked toward the waiting boat, Kins said,
You got sunscreen?
Tracy handed him the tube. He squirted the cream into his palm and applied it to the back of his neck.
I could think of worse ways to spend a Saturday afternoon.
Bet Jane Doe can't, Tracy said. Tracy and Kin spent the remainder of the afternoon getting baked by the sun. The temperature hit 90 degrees, but it felt hotter on the water, with no hint of a breeze. When Shell took them to his honey hole, several problems quickly became apparent. With the strong current and a rope longer than 80 feet, Shill could not be precise about where he'd snagged the commercial pot, or even where exactly his pot had come to rest on the sound's bottom. That increased the search area significantly. The water was also dark and murky at that depth, limiting visibility to no more than a couple feet. The divers had scoured as large an area as they deemed reasonable, but failed to find a gun or anything that appeared to relate to the woman in the trap. It didn't come as a surprise. The killer had clearly intended that the body would never be found. After getting off the water, Tracy wanted to drive home and jump in a cold shower, but that would have to wait. She and Kins returned to police headquarters downtown and met in a conference room with Foz, Dell, and Billy Williams. Foz reported that their initial canvas of the condominium and apartment buildings, as well as the marinas, had failed to produce anything significant.
"Would be better if we had a photograph," he said again.
Tracy had called Funk when she got off the boat. His office had extricated Jane Doe from the pot, but he said it was unlikely they'd get a usable photograph from the autopsy. A sketch artist might be able to fill in the significant blanks where the marine life had fed on the flesh, but at present the only thing that would come from Foz and Dell showing Jane Doe's autopsy picture to tenants in the buildings or boat owners at the marinas would be a lot of vomit. Chapter 3. After a long weekend, Tracy met Kins on Monday morning at the Medical Examiner's Building at 9th and Jefferson Street, just across from the Harborview Medical Center. The 14-story building, all tinted glass and natural lighting, was nothing like the cement tomb where the ME once worked. While the rest of the building had been dressed up, not a lot could be done to make over the processing room where Funk and his team examined and cut open victims' bodies. Cold and sterile, the room contained stainless steel tables and sinks, with drains and traps illuminated beneath bright lights. Jane Doe's body lay naked on the table closest to the door. A body block beneath her back forced her chest to stick out and her arms to slump away, making it easier for Funk to do his work. Ordinarily, there would have been a body bag, but given the nature of the crime and crime scene, that was not the case. At the moment, Jane Doe was less a human being and more a piece of evidence, something to be dissected and processed. The impersonal nature of autopsies remained a stark and harsh reality Tracy had yet to fully accept, even after 9 years working violent crimes. It stemmed from the knowledge that her sister's bones, recovered from a grave in the mountains above her hometown 20 years after Sarah had disappeared, had once been pieced together on a similar table, like a fossil find from an archaeological dig. Tracy had vowed to never forget that the body on the table had once been a living, breathing human being. She sat on a rolling stool out of Funk's way. Kin stood beside her, the two of them watching and listening as Funk dictated each step with practiced precision and documented his findings with extensive photographs. Funk had weighed and measured Jane Doe. She was 5'6", though it was difficult to be precise because the body had been manipulated to fit inside the crab pot, and weighed approximately 135 pounds. He took vaginal and rectal swabs to check for semen. He examined the skin for petechia, pinpoint round blood spots indicating asphyxia, though the cause of death was readily apparent. Jane Doe had been shot in the back of the head. The killer had likely used a 9mm handgun. Not that the gun mattered at this point. Without the bullet, which had passed through the skull, they would not be able to confirm the particular gun, if they ever found it. Funk's exterior examination revealed no jewelry, though the earlobes had been pierced, further confirming Tracy's suspicion the killer had stripped the body. Funk found no tattoos or other distinguishing marks, nor did he find track marks or other signs the woman had been a junkie. He'd taken fingerprints to run through the AFIS database, but unless the woman had been convicted of a crime, served in the military, or had been employed in a job requiring workers to be fingerprinted, the system would not provide an identity. He'd also taken blood and saliva samples for DNA analysis, but similarly, unless the woman's DNA was in the CODIS database, there would be no hit. Funk was preparing to X-ray the body.
"You okay?" Kins asked.
Tracy looked up at him from her rolling stool.
"Huh?"
"You've got that look in your eye, and you're quiet.
Too quiet."
After 8 years working together, they had become adept at reading each other's moods.
"Don't make it any more personal than it is, Tracy. This shit is hard enough."
"I don't try to make it personal, Kins."
"I know you don't try," he said, fully aware of what had happened to her sister, as well as Tracy's compulsion when it came to killers of young women.
"But sometimes you can't change the facts."
"No, but you can change how you react to them," he said.
"Maybe," she said, not wanting to sound defensive. "I was just wondering who raises the kind of person who would shoot someone in the back of the head and stuff her body in a crab pot like a piece of bait." Kins sighed. They'd had similar conversations.
"Think about it from the parents' perspective.
As horrible as it would be to hear this has happened to your child, I also can't imagine being told I'd raised a child capable of doing something like this."
"Seems like it's getting worse, doesn't it?" Tracy said.
"People have no respect for other people's boundaries. They think nothing of breaking into someone's car or home. Did you read the stories last December of people stealing Christmas presents from porches and taking lawn decorations?"
"I saw that."
"Who raises these people to think that's okay?"
"I don't know," Kin said. "When the economy isn't good, people get desperate."
"That's a load of crap," she said. "There are a lot of really poor people out there who would never think to do those kinds of things."
She looked to the body on the table.
They watched Funk work.
"What did you think of Shill?" Kins said.
"I think Foz and Dell are right. I don't think he'll be poaching crabs again anytime soon."
"I meant about what Dell said, about the odds of Shill hooking on the pot."
Tracy heard doubt, or at least skepticism, in Kins's tone.
"I don't think the kid's capable of something like this."
"I'm just saying we don't rule him out yet."
"Okay, we don't rule him out, but why would he bring the pot in and call 911 if he was somehow involved?"
Kins shrugged.
"He might have gotten cold feet. Maybe he kills her but spooks and can't go through with it, so he comes up with a different story. I hooked on the pot."
He seemed genuinely shook up.
"Doesn't mean he didn't kill her."
"No, it doesn't."
"I say we have Dell and Foz ask around, find out if any cats have gone missing in the kid's neighborhood, or if he trolls the internet for those morbid sites about murder."
"I don't know," she said.
"It's happened before," Kin said.
"What?"
"Someone finding a body in a crab pot. 2 years ago, a fisherman found a skull in a crab pot out on the coast near Westport."
"That was the guy's pot," Tracy said, recalling the story.
"Never did find out how the skull got in there, though. And then they found that body in the pot down in Pierce County, near Anderson Island."
"They didn't find it. The boyfriend confessed and led them to it."
"Exactly," Kin said.
Detectives? Funk stepped back from the table and lowered his mask. He donned full surgical gear, including protective eyeglasses. Tracy and Kins raised their surgical masks to cover their mouths and noses, though it did little to block the smell. Funk moved to the computer on the nearby table. It showed images of a series of X-rays of the woman's body. Using the mouse, Funk clicked his way through the images until finding the ones he wanted.
There, you see?
He pointed to the woman's face. She had implants on her chin and her cheekbones. She's also had her nose altered.
Plastic surgery? Tracy said.
Not the kind you're thinking of, Funk corrected. This is facial structure alteration.
Someone trying to change their appearance, Tracy said.
And recent, I'd say within the month, 2 months tops, and her hair has been recently dyed a darker color.
Funk turned back to the body.
Her natural color is light brown.
Tracy and Kins both knew from a prior investigation that implants included a serial number. Plastic surgeons were obligated to record the serial numbers in their patients' charts and provide that information to the manufacturer in case of a problem with the implant.
Looks like we can cancel the sketch artist, Kins said. We just found Jane Doe.
Kins and Tracy returned to police headquarters. Kins traced the serial numbers to Silitone, a Florida manufacturer. A Silitone worker bee took the information and called back within the hour. The implants had been shipped to a Dr. Yi Wu in Renton, Washington, a city located at the southern tip of Lake Washington, about a 20-minute ride from downtown. Kins called Dr. Wu's clinic. The staff member gave him the standard admonitions about HIPAA laws and patient privacy. She stopped talking when Kins said he was a homicide detective, investigating a potential homicide. HIPAA laws continued after a patient's death, but Kins and Tracy weren't interested in Jane Doe's private medical history. At least not yet. They just wanted to know who she was. They took a drive to Renton. Judging from the outside of the one-story stucco building, Tracy would have been nervous to get her nails done by Dr. Wu, let alone allow him to operate on her face. But according to Dr. Wu's website, he'd studied at the University of Hong Kong, did his residency in plastic surgery at UCLA, and was board-certified by the American Society of Plastic Surgeons.
Testimonials tout him as the greatest sculptor since Michelangelo, Tracy said.
And, of course, we know if it's on the Internet, it must be true, Kins said, pulling into a parking space.
They exited the car to the sound of a jet engine taking off from nearby Boeing Field and made their way to the glass doors. The interior had a distinctly Asian feel, from the decor to the half a dozen patients seated in the lobby. A petite Asian woman in blue hospital scrubs identified herself as Dr. Wu's physician assistant and said the doctor would be with them shortly.
Heard that before, Kins said as they retreated to seats in the waiting area. Can you imagine if these guys had to keep a bus driver's schedule? It would be mass chaos.
Tracy handed him a Chinese magazine from the coffee table.
At least you won't have to read a 6-month-old copy of Time.
The physician's assistant reappeared in 10 minutes. Rather than barking out their names, she discreetly indicated Dr. Wu would see them.
Kins put down the magazine. And I was just getting to a good part.
Dr. Wu stood behind his desk as Tracy and Kins entered his cramped office. Small in stature, perhaps 5'3", with large silver-framed glasses, Wu wore a white doctor's smock over a blue shirt and a maroon knit tie, the end of which he tucked into the waistband of his pants.
Thank you for seeing us, Tracy said.
Wu's hands were as soft and small as a young boy's. After introductions, he sat and opened a file already on his desk.
The implant numbers you provided my PA correspond to a patient, Lin Cora Hoff, he said in a thick Chinese accent.
Jane Doe had a name.
Simple as that.
What can you tell us about her? Tracy said.
If Wu was worried about HIPAA, he didn't express it.
He used the ball of his thumb to shove his glasses onto the bridge of his nose.
Miss Hoff is 24 years old, 5'7", 132 pounds, Caucasian. She had her nose shaved, a chin implant, and two cheekbone implants.
When was this done? Tracy asked.
June 3rd.
Recently, Kin said.
Yes, Wu said.
Had you worked with Miss Hoff before? Tracy asked.
No.
Did she say why she wanted the surgery? Tracy asked. Wu looked up as if he didn't understand the question. The glasses had already slid down the bridge of his nose.
Why?
Why she was having reconstructive surgery, Tracy said.
Many women have reconstructive surgery, Wu said, as if changing your face was an everyday occurrence.
He again used his thumb to push the glasses onto his nose. I understand, Tracy said, but this seems more invasive than routine plastic surgery.
Women, Wu looked to Kin's, and men, have surgery for many reasons.
So she didn't say why? Kin said.
She did not.
Did she provide her medical background? Tracy asked. Wu undid brass prongs at the top of the file and removed the contents. He handed Tracy a multi-page document that she shared with Kin's. The first page was a patient registration form filled out in pen. Kin's copied Lin Hoff's date of birth and social security number, as well as an address, which appeared to be an apartment in Renton. Hoff provided only a cell phone number. She did not provide an emergency contact or anyone with whom her medical information could be shared. The second page was a patient health questionnaire. Hoff had checked no to every question, noted no prior medical history or surgeries, and no current medications. As for her family history, she'd circled no to the questions of whether her mother or father were living and did not list any brothers or sisters. Tracy set down the forms. "Do you have before and after photographs?" she asked. Wu sat back in his chair.
"No."
Tracy glanced at Kin's before re-engaging Wu. "You don't have any photographs?" she said, not trying to hide her disbelief.
"No,"
Wu said again, his voice almost inaudible. "Dr. Wu, wouldn't it be normal procedure to have before and after photographs of a patient undergoing surgery such as this?"
"Yes," he said. "It is normal procedure."
"Then why don't you have any photographs?"
"Following her surgery, Ms. Hoff requested all photographs."
"She asked for the pictures you'd taken of her?"
"Yes."
"And you gave those to her?"
"She signed a waiver," Wu said.
He leaned forward, fumbled in the file, and handed Tracy a 2-page document. It was a simple release of liability. Lin Hoff acknowledged receiving all photographs in Dr. Wu's possession. In exchange, she had agreed to waive her right to bring any claim against Dr. Wu for any reason or circumstance.
"Did you have a lawyer draw this up for you?" Kins asked.
"Yes," Wu said.
"So this is unusual," Kin said.
"Yes," Wu said.
"Did Miss Hoff say why she wanted possession of the photographs?" Tracy asked. Wu shook his head.
"She did not."
Tracy suspected Wu had speculated why Lin Hoff wanted her photographs, and probably came to the same conclusions she was now formulating, that he had, maybe unwittingly, operated on a fugitive from justice or someone running from enemies. "Did Miss Hoff return for follow-up treatment?" Tracy asked.
"No,"
Wu said. "And again, was that unusual?"
"Yes."
"Did she schedule any follow-up appointments?"
"A visit was scheduled, but she did not keep that appointment."
"Did your staff call to find out why not?"
"The number provided was no longer in service," Wu said.
"Where was the surgery performed?" Tracy asked.
"Here," Wu said.
We have our accredited surgical suites. It helps keep the costs affordable.
How much does something like this cost? Kins asked.
Wu consulted his file.
$6,312.
Tracy had noticed a sign on the counter indicating Wu accepted Visa and MasterCard. How did she pay? I'm assuming insurance doesn't cover it.
No insurance, Wu said. Not for elective surgery. Miss Hoff paid cash.
Wu handed Tracy a receipt. Kins looked to Tracy, and she knew he was thinking it further evidence that Lynn Hoff was a prostitute. She made a mental note to have Dell and Foz call local Renton banks to determine if Lynn Hoff had any accounts.
How did Miss Hoff get home after surgery? Tracy asked.
I assume she couldn't drive.
A note in the file indicates she used a car service.
What about care at home after the surgery? Kins said. Would someone have to look after her?
Wu shrugged his shoulders.
I do not know.
You didn't ask her? Tracy said, deciding to push him.
No.
Didn't all of this strike you as odd, Dr. Wu?
Yes, he said.
But you didn't report it to anyone?
Report what? To who?
Wu looked at her with the flat expression of someone who had already consulted a lawyer and knew he had done nothing wrong.
My obligation is to my patient.
True, Kin said.
But your patient ended up at the bottom of Puget Sound, and our obligation is to find out who put her there and why.
Chapter 4. April 14th, 2016. Portland, Oregon.
I'm getting married. Those might be the last words I thought I'd ever say out loud. But I am. I'm standing inside the lobby of the Multnomah County Courthouse in downtown Portland, wearing, get this, a white dress. The shock is not that the dress is white. Every girl wears white, regardless of, you know. The shock is that I'm wearing a dress. I didn't even own a dress before I bought this one. I've never worn anything but pants to work, usually blue jeans. It is Portland, after all, which translated means casual. People come to work in spandex. That's not a joke. One of the insurance adjusters in our office rides his bike to work and likes to parade around in his tight shorts, showing off his package, of which he must be very proud since he does it so frequently. He comes into my cubicle asking me some inane question to get a rise out of me. Yeah, that's going to do it. If I could wash my eyes with disinfectant, I would. But I'm digressing. So, cue the music. I'm going to the altar, and I'm... Except I'm not going to the altar, or to a church, for that matter. I'm going before a justice of the peace at 3 p.m. on a Thursday afternoon. I wanted to wait for the weekend, but getting married on a weekday saves $35. And Graham, that's his name, Graham Strickland, said there's no reason to spend the extra money for the same service. No, it's not exactly the wedding every young girl dreams about. Walking down a long aisle draped on my father's arm, with the veil trailing behind me, but that dream sailed 9 years ago. I was 13 when a drunk driver crossed the center divider, went airborne, and landed on top of our car, killing both my parents. Something about being in the back seat saved me, the doctor said, like it was a good thing to be trapped alive in a car for 2 hours with your dead parents. Can you say years of counseling? I went from Santa Monica, where my father had been a doctor, to live with an aunt and uncle in San Bernardino, which is where my mother grew up, but where I didn't know a soul. I should clarify that I only lived with my Uncle Dale for about 9 months. That's when I told my counselor that my uncle liked to climb in bed with me at night. My counselor told the police, and they called Child Protective Services, and a whole shitstorm hit.
Can you say more counseling? In addition to not having a father to walk me down the aisle, I can't fill my cubicle, let alone a reception hall, with friends and family. I also don't think we could find anyone to give even a 30-second toast about Graham and me. We've known each other less than 4 months. Besides, I'm not a big cake fan anyway.